Good afternoon and good evening and good morning to all of you. It's really a pleasure to have this opportunity to be in conversation on Sunday afternoon and to take your questions and just in general continue with our Sangham, which has been so and continues to be so beautiful. So I just want to start with a sutra. Actually, it's a verse, a karika from the Spanda Karikas, which says that which in which all this creation is established and from which it arises is nowhere obstructed because it is unconditioned by its very nature. And this idea that at any moment, at any time, in any situation, we could by choice or by grace, just immerse ourselves in that source consciousness because it is ever present. It's really the great radical promise of the non-dual Shaiva systems. Here's a statement I'm quoting from Mark Dutkowski's Doctrine of Vibration. He's quoting a very early Christian mystic named Dionysius the Areopagite, speaking of God, which is very, very close to what Kashmir Shaivism says about the divine. And I want to just say something relating to that. He says, God, being one, communicates his unity into every part of the world and also into the whole, both unto that which is one and that which is many. He is one and unchangeable in a super essential manner, being neither a multiplicity of things nor yet the sum total of such units. He is a unity in a manner far different from this. He is indivisible plurality, insatiable yet brimful, producing, perfecting, and maintaining all unity and plurality. So, and of course, in our tradition, the word we would use for this unity that is also pervading all of plurality is Shakti. So I want to say this again. The divine is a unity in a manner far different than simply being the sum total of everything that exists in this universe. The divine is an indivisible plurality. That is to say, an utter, absolute, and limitless, so to speak, collection of different things. Insatiable yet brimful, which is one of the esoteric ways that the tradition talks about Goddess. She is full, and in her fullness, she's given the names like Lakshmi, that is, she's a beautiful Lalita, she's a beautiful auspicious goddess. She's also emaciated and hungry, in which case she's given names like Kali or Dhumavati. And in that emaciated or hungry state, she draws the entire cosmos into herself and then projects it outward, in which case she becomes full. So this is a wildly esoteric experience that the mystics describe when they describe reality, because they're always describing the mystical aspect of reality, their direct experience of the reality. Their interest is in realization, not philosophical speculation or theological discussion. And just one more quote, and then we'll get to your questions. This is actually my most favorite quote about liberation, and it actually comes from Abhinavagupta. He's talking about the ultimate ananda, the ultimate satisfaction of liberation. This bliss is not like the intoxication of wine or that of riches, nor similar to union with the beloved. the manifestation of the light of consciousness is not like the ray of light from a lamp, from the sun or the moon. When one frees oneself from accumulated belief in multiplicity, the state of bliss is like that of putting down a burden. The manifestation of the light is like the acquiring of a lost treasure, the domain of universal non-duality. So this is where we're going. This is the state that Kshema Raja is speaking out of. This experience of having been liberated from the idea that everything is different and separate, and this is really important, yet being able to experience the multiplicity of things, always with the understanding that they're inside. So we're going to take questions, and Deb, do we have any questions on the webcast that we want to start with?
Yes, we do. We have one from Laurel, and she says she would love if you would say more about the Para Devi, or to invoke her like you did, in the goddess class.
Para Devi. Well, just a moment of, let's say, discourse on the way goddess is explained and explored in Trika, specifically in the Kashmir Shaiva vision of Trika. The different levels of reality are presided over by goddesses, and the name for the goddess who is the expression of the highest level of reality, non-duality, is Para Devi, meaning supreme goddess. And her in the tradition where goddesses are given form, Para Devi is sometimes seen as the goddess Lalita Tripura Sundari, who is described as kind of the queen of the universe. She's beautiful. She's red in color, which symbolizes the fact that she's filled with creative desire. She's always described as being supported by five masculine deities, including two versions of Shiva, and including Brahma and Vishnu. And the point of this iconography is to point out that Para Devi Shakti is the ultimate power in the universe, and that the forms of all deities, including the masculine forms, are really expressions of her. They are, to put it in sectarian terms, they worship her, because she is the heart of what is to be worshipped. So, generally speaking, Para Devi is seen as an exquisitely beautiful goddess, queenly, all-powerful. And then as she manifests the level of, what in Shaivism is called dual, non-dual, which is that place where the non-dual world moves through the prism of Maya, and before it fully manifests in a complete separation between spirit and matter, the goddess there is called Para Para, and she's also a beautiful goddess, but her domain is the domain where the non-dual and the dual are held together. And then the goddess of the dualistic realm, who's called the Apara, meaning not supreme goddess, is often shown as emaciated, ugly, scary, simply because duality to the mind of one of these sages is scary. So I hope that starts to answer your question. The answer to the question of who is Para Devi is really contemplation. It's really an internal experience. But what I would say is, if you want to invoke this level of goddess, The way I will often do it is to close my eyes, breathe my attention into the heart, simultaneously become aware of the awareness that holds my entire experience in this moment, and then just at using ordinary English words, just say something like, O Supreme Goddess, O you who holds the world within yourself, please allow me to see this situation in the light of your beauty, in the light of your vast bliss, in the light of your intelligence. Please help me to move through my life in this moment with the awareness of your presence. So invoking Goddess is very often a matter of just turning your attention inside and asking for the sense of her presence. So, do you have any more questions on the webcast?
I think we have one more question from her. Listening to the classes again, I hear different things each time. This time, she particularly heard Shakti as Maya creates differentiation as a way to hide, conceal, veil during involution. When the lightning shoots in the other direction during evolution, differentiation is crucial in terms of subtle nuances in observation, or as you said, an experience of ever more subtle enjoyments in the sensory realm. We rise as we fall. I suppose that is what you mean. Differentiation in one direction is almost the opposite in the other direction. Is this your experience too?
Yeah, and you know, that what happens as we as you know, the journey of evolution from a spiritual point of view, and this is how the tantras speak of it, is a journey back. It's you actually climb back up, so to speak, the ladder of the tattvas, and you do it in meditation. You know, so that as you go deeper in meditation, through the grace of the goddess, through the grace of her liberating face, you actually find yourself traversing once again those steps, those stages that eventually take you past Maya into a vision of the non-dual. And I want to say, Alice wrote a question to me. I can't remember if it was on the listserv or just in a private email, in which she asked me to talk about open-eyed meditation in Tantra. And one of the characteristics of the tantric experience of liberation or, you know, spiritual awakening is something that one of my friends used to call supermarket samadhi, which is the just a kind of opening of your vision so that you're sitting in your room, you're driving your car, you're walking through the supermarket, which is where this friend of mine experienced it for the first time, and you suddenly become aware that all these different things are suffused and permeated by one energy, one source, which for some people is seen as actually experienced as light. You know, people talk about actually experiencing the objects of the world irradiated with subtle light. For me, it's never so much a visual experience as a sense, a very, very strong sense of my awareness as an almost palpable presence that's holding everything together, and in which objects seem to be tickling my awareness, if that describes it in a way that conveys the experience. It's kind of like when you're in that state, which is what I call dual non-dual, you know, you're seeing difference, but you're aware of an underlying unity. And that awareness is it's an all modes awareness. In other words, it can feel very visual, or it can, as I experience it, be much more of a kinesthetic sense of yourself containing the objects around you, the people, the trees, etc. They're all appearing inside you. And your eyes are open and you can interact with them, with everything as though it were, you know, outside you. But the overall experience is that it's all happening inside your awareness. So that's ultimately what open-eyed meditation is meant to reveal to you. And the dharanas, the awareness exercises, the affirmations that we've been practicing are all really intended to, you know, to kind of bring forth or coax forward the intention to see the wholeness in everything, which eventually does give you an experience of it. So let's go to questions from all of you. Anyone has?
And we need something to just say, if you'd like to ask a question, just hit star 2.
Thank you, Dev.
Okay, we got our first one.
Hi, guys.
Christine.
Hi, Sally.
Hi, Christine.
Hi there. Full disclosure, my heart is pounding. And I'm about to cry, so give me a second.
Oh, sure.
So, my pattern through this life has been one you described in the goddess empowerment or the wisdom goddess is like Lakshmi. So if there's any kind of conflict or difficulty, it's been to kind of just disappear, you know, just kind of fade into the woodwork. And my edge right now has been really to, and here my voice is getting stronger, so yay, I'm sinking back down. Hang on. So my edge really has been to speak my truth in love, of course. I understand in my power. And I think in addressing Alice's question, you already really gave a powerful pointer to me. I actually have both the visual, you know, the shimmering of objects and a kinesthetic felt sense of everything being held within this awareness that I am.
Mm-hmm.
But these practices, we're trying to deepen our realization, and it's about awakening. And also, it's about where the rubber meets the road and how we express ourselves in the world and how we kind of step into our divinity while being fully human.
Yes.
And so my question really, you may have answered it, but I don't know, I just like to chat a little bit. My question really is about, oh my gosh, because this is an edge for me, staying in relationship, maintaining relation. And when you said, you know, feel the felt sense of awareness and my awareness that's holding all, and see this shimmering oneness, you know, kind of like surfing reality brought that shimmering sponda to us. Or like this last week, I just was, you know, my open-eyed practice was, you know, everything is chitti, everything is chitti, you know, here it is, be in it. But, you know, speaking this edge that we talk about where, you know, for me, I was, you know, not allowed to speak. Children were seen, not heard. I actually, I'm wanting to censor myself, but I'm going to go ahead. I also actually had my mouth taped, you know, adhesive tape a lot when I was a kid. I had big energy and wanted to sing and dance and also yell no, and that wasn't okay. It was threatening to my caregivers. And so I've been trying, you know, to step in and speak what I know to be true, and that takes great courage, you know. And yet to do that while maintaining relationship with, you know, people I care about deeply, people don't want to hear no, especially the deeply conditioned childlike needy part that doesn't want to hear no, you know.
Yeah, I know.
And so if you could speak to this dance, this razor's edge of truth and love and you know, protective no and the justice of no, you know, kind of being a global social witness, and then the yes that's boundaryless or the yes that really is affirmative and speaking from this truth of the pervasive one in unity. I would love to hear what you have to say from Kashmir Shaivism in your own experience.
It's a really good question, and it is the heart of the edge that I think a lot of us feel. You know, at a certain point, we've turned to spiritual practice essentially for self-cultivation. And the more we cultivate the self, you know, the more we cultivate our subtle inner sense of reality, the more we become aware of all the ways in which the world is unfair. And the more we become aware of the what I would call soul preferences as opposed to personal preferences, and the more we become aware of what our karmic work is in this lifetime. And this is what I want to speak to because, you know, each of us has different temperaments and different karmic issues that we're working with. And for some of us, those issues are about letting go of our neediness towards really others and towards relationship. And for some of us, it's about cultivating relationship. And, you know, we're always a little bit moving on the personal edge between how much to be, that, you know, for, you know, how shall I say, accommodating to others, and how much to stand up for a truth that may not be accommodating. And I would say that the true tantric skill is to be able to discern how to do this in the moment. And though, you know, there is a lot of work that's been done on things like nonviolent communication and how you word your no, and how you, you know, you work with another person when they're upset by your no. The truth is that it is always, I believe, about connecting your heart to the other person's heart and then feeling a very strong sense of energetic boundary that allows you to be both open-hearted and also aware of boundary as a, you know, as a necessary self-protection that you can bring online when you need it. And then speaking truth in the way that's appropriate in that moment, which sometimes is very kind and very sweet and sometimes has to be forceful. You know, so that's the thing. We move in a universe that's constantly changing, right? So our reactions have to constantly change. I know I can hear you want to say something. So, Christine, so...
No, I'm sobbing. Go ahead. I'm listening to you, please. I don't want to say a word.
Okay, so that's what I would say each one of us is learning in our own way is the tantric skill of living life from the highest perspective while dealing with the world of duality in the most skillful way. And the truth is that we can never be sure that we're doing it, quote, right. And yet having the understanding that she is working through us and that our intention is what matters, and that we really are in training, and that if your intention is clear, if your desires have been clarified, then you can look at your mistakes, and we all make them, you know, as part of the training, and then make amends when necessary, and also discern, you know, what we are responsible for and what we're not responsible for, because that's, you know, that confusion is an enormously mayic aspect of our experience. So So I wish I could give you some rules of the road here.
No, it's wonderful. No, it's wonderful because you just spoke to my other question, my other confusion, and that is, what is my responsibility? And isn't it? Because, you know, all my life I came in and everything is my responsibility.
Yeah,
the part of
yeah.
me that has to fix and do good and heal and be better and control and understand, you know, understand the sutras, that part of
yeah.
the mind that's trying to make sense of duality, to make sense of it. So that's what you spoke to.
Yeah.
But what I'm hearing, if you don't mind if I speak it and you can correct
yeah.
me, what I'm hearing is this beautiful transmission of and training to and resonating with Shakti and Spanda and the highest expression of her in the moment, connecting to my heart and the other's heart. And speaking from that.
Yeah, yeah.
Speaking from that. And then I don't really have to discern responsibility. That can come because so much of this happens, you know, in my life, in the moment. You know, on the listserv, we have time to stop and, you know, meditate and look for practices or talk with our partner or email you. But in the moment, in the heat of big life, if we just resonate to her transmission, or what was the word you used? You didn't say resonate or transmission. You said what we entrain to.
Yeah.
Just entrain to that beautiful underlying source, this, the great heart we're talking about, or the Spanda, then we're okay. If we're walking in that and breathing in that and singing and dancing in that and crying in that and feeling the sadness of the pain that duality comes from in that, there's the edge and the beauty of a life lived.
Yeah,
as a trinka.
Yeah, yeah, it's beautiful. It's beautiful. Thank you, Christine. So, someone wrote in last week about trying to understand her dharma in a, you know, what is the right thing to do? And I remembered as I was writing back to her a statement that from the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is a book of mythological stories about Krishna, Vishnu, and his different incarnations. And in this particular situation, Krishna is talking to his disciple Uddhava, who's kind of along with Arjuna, one of, you know, his closest friend. And Krishna, remember, is the ultimate tantrika. I feel that, you know, that as a figure in, you know, in the Indian pantheon, he really incarnates this mystery of how to be completely poised in the infinite and act in the world. So one of the things he says to Uddhava is the mystery of right action has been concealed by me. Rather than making rules about how you're supposed to act in every situation, I'm paraphrasing. I've deliberately left it vague so that you get to discern at any given moment what the right action is. You know, it's kind of what the Christians say when they talk about free will. We have that freedom, and that's our path. So, yeah. So, thank you, Christine. So we have two more hands up.
Yes, we have someone in Florida with your hand up. I've unmuted you. Go ahead and speak.
Okay, that would be me, I think.
Okay.
I'm in Panama City, and this is Phyllis.
Hi.
Hi, Sally.
How are you, Phyllis?
It's always well,
yeah.
Just
yeah.
Delighted to be in this class, and always just pure joy to be with you and with the others in the community. I think as we've been studying the Sutra 8, and as we've been sort of dipping down into the depths of the density of contraction, it's almost as like I am following, so I am, you know, empathizing so much with the story that I really find myself becoming very contracted. You know, when someone mentioned, I think it was Alice mentioning the sorrow that she felt, it was about a particular issue, but for me, this sutra brings up sorrow. It feels sorrowful. And
how can this happen, how come we've done this to ourselves?
Exactly, so much so, and so much suffering from this position. So, and I did, I mean, actually, I'm not a very Kali-esque person ordinarily, but I did have this experience this week where an argument with someone I loved just came out of nowhere. I swear it didn't make any sense at all. And it felt like energy just there and ready to happen. And I could see it afterwards. And, of course, it had come after an expansive experience, which, you know, often like, you do have that expansion and then the contraction. I know that. But it did seem very different than ordinary. So I guess I'd like to know just any feedback you might have on that. And also, with the malas, I'm just so fascinated about the way in which they work and how they manifest. And especially, you know, I love the homework offering that you gave us, the parts where you kind of stepped us, started with the densest and then to the next level and then to another level. And that was so much better. I mean, it was so much clearer at that point how that happened.
Mm-hmm. It's really true. It's really true.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say something about, you know, what I think is happening when you have a Kali-esque outburst that's not usual for you.
Okay.
You know, the truth is, Phyllis, you and many of you guys in this class you've done a lot of practice, and you've cleared out a lot of the egotistical, you know, confusion that human beings normally carry. And as that starts to happen, you then become a vehicle for divine energies in very unexpected ways. And sometimes that energy, it needs to be sharp. So, and in terms of Kali energy, in terms of that sharp energy, the energy that, you know, that comes out angrily or comes out harshly or comes out in a loud voice, it works through our wounds, you know, that voice is coming out in a out of our wounds. But very often it's also carrying truth. So, and when you're a gentle person and you're not, you know, and you're not used to letting your strong emotions come up and get, you know, carry you away, when it comes out like that, the self-inquiry that you might consider is how much of this is unexpressed anger that, you know, has been buried because of my basically pleasant nature, and how much of it is the voice of Kali, because this person needs to have a sharp, you know, response or a sharp correction at this moment. Mm-hmm. I think you can assume that whatever is, you know, coloring your response because of your package, because of your, you know, because of your personal issues, I would say that it's that the chances are that the bulk of the force behind what came up is actually her. It's not you in the ordinary egoic sense. And as this starts to happen, and it does start to happen, I know it has for many of you, it certainly has for me, there's this intensity that comes up from time to time. And we're, especially women, are conditioned to you know, be uncomfortable with that.
Okay.
But,
yeah.
You know, it's, in a certain sense, there's a spontaneous expression of intensity that every one of us, experiences and expresses at certain moments. And I would say that that is probably what's happening here. It
mm-hmm.
also can have something to do with the, you know, the way the energies are playing in the cosmos, and let's face it, they're pretty crazy right now.
Right.
You know, it's like, pretty, this is a time of really kind of maximally crazy energy in many spheres. So, you know, as sensitive, you know, sort of channels for the energy of the cosmos, which we all are to some extent, and spiritual people usually to a greater extent, this is probably also a factor.
Mm. Yes. All of that.
All of that, yes.
All of that. Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you for
thank
that.
Thank you. I know what you're
yeah.
talking about.
Okay. And that and that. Thank
yeah.
you.
Thank
yeah.
you, Phyllis.
Mm-hmm.
Is there, you know...
Hey. I'm sorry. Did you want to go to the next one? Or sorry.
I just wanted to ask, Phyllis, does that, you know, when you listen to what I said, is there something in you that's saying, no, it's not like that, or maybe, do you know what I mean? Do you have a response that you'd like
Hold
to
on
share
a
with?
Sec. I've got to unmute her. Okay. Go ahead, Phyllis. Sorry.
Oh, no, actually, I think that when I hear you say it's possibly coming through your wounding, and, you know, it's and it needed to be said, and it needed to be said in a certain way. I think that's true. I think that's true. I think where I stumble is wondering whether my perspective on this is accurate, whether I have a right to be angry about something. So,
yeah. Well,
yeah.
here's a dharana you can do.
Okay.
What if I'm wrong?
Okay.
Just hold that thought. What if I'm wrong?
What if I'm wrong?
And hold it with the sense that you're open to feeling into other perspectives.
Yes.
And I would say one of the smart things that nonviolent communication, which I'm not, you know, completely sold on, but I think one of the things that is smart in, you know, in that particular formulation is to remember to say, this is my experience. You know,
okay.
So this is how I'm feeling, so that you're not, you're not taking the position of, I have the authority and I'm absolutely right to tell you this, but more
mm-hmm.
like this is how I'm experiencing the situation. This is what I'd like to say to you, somehow then the question of whether you're right to be upset is not so much the issue.
Yeah, yeah, I see what you're saying. Speaking my truth or standing in my truth. Yeah, I understand that. And yet, when it came out in that burst, I didn't use those words.
Right.
You know
no, I know, and we often don't. And
no.
So here we get to know.
So it was just
capable.
A kind of a real blast. It was, you know,
it
sounds. Anymore. It was like
right,
that.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we know.
I know
the
it's my growing. It is my
yeah.
growing edge is to be able to comfortably express anger. And even and the one time I couldn't even feel it. So I'm pretty far along the path from where I started.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Phyllis. Bye. Okay, we have someone in Oakland, someone in Minnesota.
Yep. I just, oh, whoever's there.
That's
me.
I think it's me. I think it's me. This is Lakshmi, actually, in Washington, D.C., with an Oakland number.
Oh, hi, Lakshmi.
Okay. Hi. I guess my question is, I almost didn't sign up for this course. I signed up kind of late because my life is rather intense as I've been managing my father's life and health and really become his parent, which has been a really big and dramatic shift for me. And in the middle of that, my other mentor in life passed away suddenly, who was staying at my father's house. So it's been this very intense period. But then I knew that being in the Sangam, even with whatever limited ability I would have, not to my true desire to show up, but to just absorb whatever I could, that would still be what I needed. And so I'm a little bit far behind, but I just wanted to ask, I think this feels right, but the teaching from the first class of my heart is the divine heart, when you started guiding us through that, I had some kind of like crack open that I didn't even know I was holding tension in a way. And that teaching was such a, I can't even really describe it. But working, I basically for the last several weeks, just since I listened to that first class, have really mostly been working with my heart as the divine heart and my awareness as the divine awareness. And because that's, I've just been trying to really, you know, as you say, steep myself in it like tea. And that alone has been really rather radical. And I guess I just wanted to ask, I mean, I think I have a sense that you'll say, like, that's okay if that's what I can do and that's what's working. And from what you said to Alice, that's kind of what all of the other teachings and practices are guiding us towards. But I guess I just wanted to hear you. I'll give a little example because it's really not that little. I just came back from visiting my father. I moved him into assisted living about half an hour from me, and he's not always doing that great. But I tonight was the first time I had to change his diaper, and I, you know, just kind of was noticing all the energy and the feeling and the very complicated emotional and thought relationship to that moment and everything that was happening and the history and the whole thing. And I just, you know, I've been practicing so much with compassion and heart energy with you, but it was different this time. That kind of gut instinct of my heart as the divine heart just made me it just made me able to do it in a way that I haven't been able to do that previously. So I guess, you know, and even just from all the kind of anxiety and grief and challenging emotions that I've been working with, to just kind of really feel much more deeply, you know, from all the work we've been doing on the gunas, like, okay, I understand we're surfing, but to actually somehow be able to feel into it in that moment, in the greater context of connection to other people and aliveness, somehow has been, it's still cooking me, but I guess I just wanted to ask you about that.
Well, I would say that part of the fruit, the grace of this work, of this teaching, is that in a situation that's very fraught, you know, I mean, having to change your father's diaper, I was in that situation myself. I know how, you know, how it just upends your ideas about how the world is. If that ability to remember the you know, the divinity of your own heart, which, of course, is his heart as well, it is going to make all these things that we do that we ordinarily would find difficult or weird or freaky or painful, it actually makes it possible to go through very challenging situations with an open heart. And I consider that one of the great fruits of studying, really studying non-dual tantra, is the way it can affect your feelings about the stuff that you have to do in your life.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
And I would say, you know, if there's a particular affirmation or dharana that is really powerful for you, and that one is it's one of those, it's often said, ask the question by answering which all questions are answered. This is one of those affirmations. You know, that that to really hold my heart as a divine heart, my awareness as divine awareness, it's a big enough concept that it can hold a lot. You know, it can take you through a lot of different situations.
Yeah, so, it feels like that for me. It really does, because I've been trying not to give myself a hard time about, you know, not being the kind of student that I want for teachings that I know are so revelatory, but that alone has been such an anchor that I feel
absolutely
the gift of it, you know, and I guess it's okay to just keep doing that then.
It's totally okay. And I would say that, you know, if you're, and I know this is true for many people in the class, that if, you know, it's when you're really busy and there's not much time in between, it feels like, you know, it's 2 days between the last class and the next class and you're way behind. Just give yourself permission to listen to the class when you're taking a walk or to listen to the class when you're, I would say even while you're driving, even though I know the classes tend to put everyone into meditation, so sometimes it's a little dangerous to do it while you're driving. But in other words, just let yourself bathe in the teachings, whatever chance you've got.
That's what I'm doing.
Yeah, so that's perfect.
Yeah.
Best of blessings, Lakshmi, on this very, very powerful and difficult and also beautiful thing that you're doing.
Yeah, thank you. When you just mentioned about the commentary on Dharma, and I remember something that you had said once, which is, what is the Dharma that you can do that no one else can do? And it struck me that this path I'm on with my father is one of those.
Totally.
One of those for me. So, yeah,
totally.
I recognize that. Yeah.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. We've got someone from, looks like North Carolina. And you had your hand up?
Yes, this is Gail. Yes. Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah.
Hi, Sally.
Hi, Gail.
My question is about aloneness and the feeling of being alone. And I was wondering if that's a part of the Anavamala. It feels like I can go into expanded states when I meditate and chant and things like that, and just in living life, I can be happy. And at the same time, there are moments that I feel utterly alone, and I am alone a lot in my life right now. And I have friends and things like that, but I feel like it's deeper than just like aloneness in the moment. It feels like just my soul feeling alone.
Yeah.
It's sad, you know. There's a sadness in it. Like I was talking to Shakti today and going like, Why do you want this for us? Why are you veiling me and keeping me from feeling oneness, you know? Why?
Why do you think?
I don't know. I was protesting with her. But
it's a very good question. I mean, even though Buddha said the issue is not why, the issue is what we can do, what can we do about it?
Yeah.
I think the question of why it's a good question to ask with the intention of opening to what she has to say about it, which is partly going to be personal to you, but that feeling of aloneness and sadness and being cut off is very much a symptom. I call it Anavamala syndrome because it's very much the felt sense that arises in us when we become aware of our separation from the wholeness. And of course, because, you know, Mayimala arises and we have very particular and specific feelings of being alone, like missing another person or having lost someone close to us, or, you know, all the human ways in which loneliness gives us pain. But But in terms of the source of aloneness and the cure for the feeling of aloneness, it really is to, you know, to reconnect with your source. Because, of course, at the source, you're connected to millions of forms. So I think that that's something to really contemplate. Like, where does this feeling of being alone come from? To what extent can I work with it in human terms? Because, you know, we are humans. And to what extent am I feeling the longing for reconnection with the divine wholeness that has been really fueling you for so much of your life? You know, it's so much of your motivation, is based on this longing to connect to the self, to connect to Goddess, to connect to the divine. So if we really take seriously what the teachings say about Anavimala, to the point where we realize that ultimately our sense of loneliness, aloneness, cut-offness, it's really the breadcrumb trail that can make us aware of our longing to reconnect and, you know, perhaps inspire us to just ask her to show you. You know what I'm saying?
I do. What I hear is, and I think this is what you're saying, is to go into the aloneness. I'm
right
there.
Yeah.
And so
exactly.
I need to practice that. To welcome the aloneness and go into the aloneness. And it's just like I need to deepen my connect. I want to deepen my connection within that aloneness, you know?
Yeah. So,
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, sweetie. So, do we have other questions?
And we don't have any other questions.
Okay. So let's give you a call. Let's give a question opportunity. Anyone would like to
hit star 2 if you'd like to ask a question.
Yeah. And if no one has a question, we'll have some time for meditation. So
we just got one. Wolf.
Oh, okay.
Wolf.
Hi.
Wolf just raised his hand.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hi.
I have another of those deep questions that has been following me all my life. And when I talk to my study partner here, he had the same question that encouraged me to ask it. The question is why, of course, again. And my why is, so the Goddess is all-powerful, then, and I do understand the tatras and the descent, but I imagine if I were all-powerful and had to create a world, I would create a world without suffering. You know, why do children die of hunger, and why is there abuse, and why is there all the suffering in this world? So why did, or does, or did the Goddess not create a world without suffering?
Yeah. Well, this is a question that you might ask in your meditation. I'm going to tell you why the conclusion I've come to in regard to this, which I would say is perhaps at the heart of the religious understanding of theodicy, you know, the idea that the world is, among other things, a tapestry within which souls get to do what is necessary in order to recognize the reality of non-duality. I have two thoughts about this. One is that I do think there's a good case to be made for the fact that it kind of got out of control. You know, in other words, the manifestation, goddess's manifestation as the world is, it's not, you know, what I think we come to understand is that goddess is not a control freak. In other words, she is playing as all of this, including as the suffering itself and as the sufferers. And, you know, in the various ways in which religious traditions have found for explaining suffering, the one that makes most sense to me, and, you know, in which the tradition seems to believe as well, is that the suffering is, in a certain sense, the goad that gets us to start questioning our assumptions about life. And without it, we'd be in the God world, you know, which if you know what the tradition says about especially the Tibetans say about the different planes of reality.
Right. Yes, I know.
Yeah, so you know what the God world is. And for those of you who don't, the God world is, in Eastern mythology, it's the region in which souls who have done lots of good actions go to spend time, and there is no suffering. It's just, you know, party, party, party. You know, just with one thought, you can put on a new body. You can, you know, it's an incredibly privileged, wonderful world. And yet, I wouldn't say no, because there's no such thing as no in this universe. But, you know, the opportunities for self-realization are much smaller in that realm, precisely because there is no suffering, and therefore there's no questioning. You know, you're just enjoying the fruits of your merit. So, you know, I do think that in terms of the efficacy of Shakti setting up the situation such that she, living as Wolf or Sally or Phyllis or any one of us, has the maximum, let's call it inspiration, to start asking the big questions, I would say that suffering is a very efficient way to do it. The other thing that sometimes occurs to me, and it makes a lot of sense, is that perhaps when Goddess decided to become many, she was not fully thinking through the consequences. You know what I mean? She didn't really realize how dense it would get. I mean,
that was my thought.
Yeah, I think that there's much to be said for that. And, you know, how it is when you make something. Especially if it involves lots of other people. How do you, know what it's going to turn out
like? Well, in the Tibetan tradition, the God world is the worst one to be in, because you party for 2 billion years and then you actually do die, and
exactly.
And you end up in the deepest doo-doo.
Exactly.
But so
you're out of
so
practice.
Because you have no opportunity to move up. You up already, you know, but you're not.
Yeah.
You don't know it.
Yeah.
But the question then related to this is, so is the world of the goddess, let's take Lakshmi and Bhuvaneshwari and all the others that we know of, Paramashiva, for instance, is that world without suffering?
Yeah. I mean, at the non-dual levels, you know, the pure, the levels of pure awareness, the so-called pure tattvas, because everything is inside us, there's not that kind of suffering that, you know, that intense, dense dense suffering. I suspect, and many spiritual traditions say this, especially the Jewish tradition, that our suffering is experienced by the divine. In other words, that there is nothing that can happen in all these planes of existence that is not being felt inside the awareness, inside Goddess's awareness. Now, obviously, you know, because of the vastness of her perspective, it's not the same kind of overwhelm. You know, there's not the identification with the suffering part of us that we have, which, as you probably know from your own experience, makes a huge difference in how you experience discomfort and pain.
Right. Yeah, but it seems that, you know, it's not just human suffering. This whole earth,
Gaia,
you know, the first microbes who lived ate other microbes, and the animals, the predators eat prey, and there is suffering everywhere, you know, and so the whole world seems to be created. So it's not just a freak accident that we humans suffer. We are born. My original idea was, okay, this is jail. Earth is jail. We are sent down here to, you know, to improve. And the only way to get out of jail is to improve. But then who in his right or who in her right mind would create a jail? You know, so that's I don't get out of that dichotomy here.
I don't believe. Again, we're speculating, but I don't think you have to look at it as a jail. I think you can look at it as the arena of growth.
Well, a halfway house, you know.
But what the texts say is that they say the earth plane is karma bhumi. It's the place where actions have consequences, which means that we can learn and also that we can change things. You know, that transformation is possible, and we are seeing that. We see that every day, right? And that transformation can be the painful destruction of the earth, or it can be, you know, what happened in, you know, all over the world when we started having emissions controls. That is, the air became breathable in, you know, in cities where you choked every time you took a breath. And I used to live in Los Angeles in the 70s. You know, it's extraordinary how much just simple physical transformation is possible through the truth that actions have consequences in this plane, right? One of my favorite mysterious hymns from the Rig Veda says it has the priest chanting, "I am food. I am the eater of food. I am food. I am the eater of food." You know, that this universe is, that's how this universe is. Everything ingests everything else, assimilates everything else.
Yeah. Well, one of the early stories of Buddha was that he was first in the hell realm, and then, first he was an animal. He was a tiger, and then he met as a tiger this hungry tiger mother with seven cubs, and offered himself as food. You know, so
So there's something in that story about accepting. You know, accepting that full catastrophe, to use John Kabat-Zinn's wonderful phrase.
Yeah, well, thank you. I mean, it's a kind of a philosophical discussion, but I it's very comforting to me that. You said to the previous person that. Well, sometimes there's no answer to why, and let's just go do it, you know. It doesn't matter why.
I quoted Buddha. Remember his famous statement? If you ask, you know, if someone has shot an arrow into you, Do you ask yourself, why was this arrow shot? Who shot it? Was it a Brahmin or a Kshatriya? Those are not the questions to ask. What you want to do is pull the arrow out.
And he
was, of course, Mr. Practical. So having recognized that life is suffering, his interest is in what's the path out of suffering, not so much why is life suffering. But nonetheless, it's the question we all ask: why suffering? And it's a stickler for a lot of people. It's hard to get past it.
Uh-huh.
And in the Jewish mystical tradition, where that's a tradition in which there's a lot of discussion and a lot of argument and a lot of interpretation of texts. So there's a story about a rabbi who actually called God. He set up a rabbinical court, and he called God to come into the court and answer for human suffering. We don't know what God's response was, but it's obviously it's a question that demands deep contemplation. And doing whatever we can to make things better. In a way, that's our part of our job is to recognize suffering and find out what the most skillful way there is to alleviate it in our sphere, whether with ourselves or the people around us.
Thank you, Sally.
You're welcome. Thank you for the question.
That arrow metaphor kind of did it. It's I'm here to pull out the arrow, and also that's hey, that's what it is. Thank you.
That's what it is. We're here to pull out the arrow, and so we are at the end of our time. Again, I really appreciate the questions, the personal ones, the philosophical ones, and the variety of questions. So let's just take 2 minutes to sit, and I'd like to practice with the sense of the Sushumna Nadi, the central channel running between the coccyx all the way up to the crown and then running down into the earth and running up to the sun or the moon, or simply into the sky. And just allow the breath to flow down the inner body. So the breath flows in through the nostrils and flows down the inner body, down to the coccyx, with the inhalation, and then flows back up with the exhalation. And in this moment, let's practice with the mantra Soha or Soham, if that's more natural to you, with that recognition. Every breath reminds me that I am that vast consciousness. I am that. And when I open my eyes and look around, look at the world that appears to be outside, this mantra also reminds me, I am that. So I'll just let the breath flow down towards the base and up towards the crown, flowing through the inner body with Soha. And the awareness, I am that which is immeasurably vast, powerful, all-knowing, perfect, blissful, limitless. And I am also this body. I am this room. I am this planet. I am this solar system. I am this cosmos. All of this. I am all of this. So hum. Thank you all. Have a beautiful evening or day, depending on where you are in the world. And we'll see each other on the listserv and again on Wednesday night. Big, big love to all of you. Good night.